Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Exploring the Lord of the Rings. This is session number 293. And tonight it is time for yet Mordor. I'm coming fresh from Sunshine Moot this week. Another delightful Sunshine Moot without any sunshine. That has become traditional, actually. We haven't had sunshine at Sunshine Moot in several years now. It always rains at Sunshine Moot. But it was awesome. Such a wonderful time. I got to hang out with several regular folks here down at Sunshine Moot. And it is always just a delight to connect with that group of folks again. Sunshine Moot tends to be small but just delightful. We were talking about poetry and song all day long, so we had some really really fun discussion. And I was kind of warming up. Pretty soon now, we're gonna be getting to Gimli's song, his Khazad Dûm song, Song of Durin, and I gave a talk on that at Sunshine Moot this past weekend, and I'm really looking forward to going through that with you guys, because it's gonna be a lot of fun. So Emily, I don't encourage anyone to sing like Circus's Bombadil ever. But anyway, Gimli's song will be after next Sunshine Moot, though. You think? Think it's going to take us a whole year to get to Gimli's song? I don't know. That seems kind of unlikely, don't you think? I don't know. yeah, we'll see. We'll see. We'll see how we do. But today, we will begin. Maybe if we get a second slide in, our second slide today would be Boromir kind of losing it a little bit. Oh, Ambrosius, no, you really don't have to. So the reference is to Andy Serkis's reading of the Fellowship of the Ring. I honestly have to admit, I did not get past Tom Bombadil. His reading of Tom Bombadil made me so angry that I had to stop listening for my own mental health. So I couldn't, unfortunately. Anyway, yeah, Boromir is going to have some things to say here soon. And this is one of the most interesting. All of Boromir's speeches are interesting, and I'm looking forward to that. But we'll see. We'll see where we get to. Let's jump back in. I have put the illustration back in case we want to refer back to it again, but we're mostly done talking about the inscription. We talked about the translation last time, which was a really good conversation in which I learned a lot. Let's move on to Mary's insightful question. What does it mean by speak, friend, and enter? Asked Mary.
That is plain enough, said Gimli. If you are a friend, speak the password and the doors will open and you can enter.
Yes, said Gandalf. These doors are probably governed by words. Some dwarf gates will open only at special times or for particular persons, and some have locks and keys that are still needed when all necessary times and words are known. These doors have no key. In the days of Durin, they were not secret. They usually stood open, and door wards sat here. But if they were shut, any who knew the opening word could speak it and pass in. At least, so it is recorded, is it not, Gimli?
It is, said the dwarf. But what the word was is not remembered. Narvi and his craft and all his kindred have vanished from the earth.
Okay, so notice we talked last time about how Gandalf seems a little bit dismissive of the inscription, right? That is how at least it's clear from the context of how he reads it, when he does, in fact, read it in response to Frodo's question, that he's not looking at it very carefully, that he thinks it's just ornamental. He doesn't really seem to process the fact that it's a riddle, right? Speak, friend, and enter. Because remember, he begins by saying, it doesn't say anything of importance to us, right? And Gimli clearly agrees, right? It's plain enough what speak, friend, and enter means, right? Now, Mary, if we again, see, I knew we'd want the illustration. If we go back, Mary clearly picks up on one of the cues that the writing does in fact give, right? The writing, both in its purport and even in its visual structure, draws attention, I think, to the speak, friend, and enter, in that it is the only thing, you know, we've got on the one side of the arch, right? The doors of Durin, Lord of Moria, speak, friend, and enter, and then, you know, Einarvi, you know, Einarvi made them, Celebrimbor of Holland drew these signs, right? Everything else is just label, right? There's nothing else. Gandalf would be quite right to say that there's nothing else in a sense of purport to that, right? That there's not anything of importance to them. It's of a purely historical interest who it was who made the doors, or who carved the signs, or whose doors they were, right? Even Durin is at this point, though an important historical figure, merely of historical interest, right? But what Mary seems to pick up on is that there is definitely one of these things is not like the other element to this inscription, right? If all it said were the doors of Durin, Lord of Moria, Einarvi made them, Celebrimbor of Holland drew these signs, it would just be like, here's the title and here's the photographic credits, right? Underneath, literally in small print. And it would just, the whole thing would seem clearly just to be a label, right? But speak, friend, and enter is different. The whole register is different. It addresses the reader directly, right? It's not a label. You know, it's not a label. It's an imperative. It's, you know, therefore sort of implicitly in the second person. Right? It definitely stands out. It definitely stands out from the rest of those things. And so Mary immediately focuses on that. What does it mean by that? Why does it say that in the middle of all of these other titles and names and notes, right? Why should it say, speak, friend, and enter? Now, Gimli's answer is quite plausible. If you're a friend, speak the password and the doors will open and you can enter. And that's, of course, perfectly correct. He's not wrong, right? He's not wrong with that interpretation. And Gandalf immediately piles in. Right. Now, Bob is asking, why tell people that you need to speak the password? Wouldn't they know that? Well, Bob, that's an interesting question, right? In the sense that the only people who could read that would have already known the words by which you had to summon the Ithildien, you know, to activate the Ithildien in the first place, right? So, yeah, does seem to me a little bit unnecessary, actually. Because one of those two things is going to be true, isn't it? Either the doors are going to be standing open and door wards are going to be sitting there like people you could ask or talk to, or the doors will be shut. So, yeah, It seems curious. One thing that I wonder, and of course Gandalf doesn't specify this, just thinking back, this occurred to me after our conversation last time. I wonder how long the Ithildien remains activated when you activate it. That is, when they did close the gates, Gandalf says they usually stood open, but if they were shut, any who knew the opening word could speak it and pass in. I wonder if they left the Ithildien activated during, like, when the doors were shut, so that deactivating one of the two-factor authentication systems, right? Fourth Dauntless guesses that the writing remains until moonset. Perhaps. The Ithildien does fade as soon as Gandalf starts trying passwords, Cal Elros says. Yeah, that's true. We haven't seen that. We haven't gotten there yet. But yeah. I don't know. Matt, that seems to be the way that Gandalf is gonna interpret it, right? That putting the password right on the door could be serving as a kind of promise, one sadly broken during the dark times, of eternal friendship between the dwarves of Moria and the elves of Eregion. It's almost as if Gandalf is gonna make it sound like there's no security on these doors at all. And yet, they did in fact, like, presumably it was in their power to make doors that just opened, right? Like, that dwarves would in fact have the technology to make a door that just unlocked, you know, normally. If the point were to leave the doors, you know, to leave it accessible at all times, presumably they could have managed that, right, if they had wanted to, but instead they make these highly secure magical doors, right, which are impenetrable if you don't have the password, and yet with the password right there, right, in print on the door. It's interesting because Matt, anyway, I'm thinking about, you know, your talk of sort of a declaration of permanent friendship, which I agree. I mean, that feels right, and that does feel very much like what Gandalf is going to go on to describe later. But at the same time, these gates are eminently lockable as well, right? Yeah. So, Little Room Johnny, they would be totally symbolic rather than functional. I mean, like, again, theoretically, they could have just made, like, a pair of swinging saloon doors here, right? I mean, I get just, like, something that doesn't close. Something that's, or, you know, maybe it could even be lockable, theoretically. Like, you could put a bar down or something. You know, you could bar the door, should you choose to. But these doors are designed by Narvi. To be ye old standard high security dwarf doors, right? That can't be detected when they're closed, that can't be opened by force, all of those things, right? Unless you couldn't read the Tengwar praise, that's true. Though, at that time, that wouldn't have excluded all that many people, right? I mean, Tengwar were not a secret. And Trifle, I agree. The evidence that they did in fact keep the armies of Sauron out of Moria, that does sound convincing to me. But again, the point is, Narvi didn't build them for that occasion, like on that occasion, right. The mode of Beleriand. Look, I don't know the mode of Beleriand, and I can make out a lot of it, right? That is to say, like, it's not, the mode of Beleriand is different, but it's not that hard, if you know any of the Tengwar at all. And I agree the first authentication is significant, that is getting the Ithildien to turn, to show up in the first place. However you cut it, I do not believe, and this goes back to some of the things we were talking about before, I do not believe we can turn ourselves around into believing that these doors are actually highly secure and impenetrable because of, like, low literacy rates or the obscurity of the mode of Beleriand or something like that. Right. That's not a way to go about securing your your kingdom, right? And none of those things would have served as an obstacle to Sauron, certainly. But I also don't think that it's just a ludicrously easy riddle which Sauron just never cracked. Right. Gandalf's characterization here, JJ, as you say, he does do some contrasting, right? These doors are probably governed by words. And then he gives his little lecture. Some dwarf gates will open only at special times. We know one of those. We've met one of those, right? The Durin's Day door. Or for particular persons. Okay, we didn't meet one of those. And some have locks and keys that are still needed when all necessary times and words are known. Again, remembering this side door to Erebor, right? These doors have no key. In the days of Durin, they were not secret. They usually stood open and door wards sat here, but if they were shut, any who knew the opening word could speak it and pass in. At least so it is recorded, is it not, Gimli? Now that's important, right? So there is a written record of Moria. There's a written record of these gates that Gandalf has read and that he assumes Gimli has also read, right? David on YouTube was asking, it's basically like a lie detector, you know, if you're really a friend or not. Painter was suggesting it's more like a declaration of friendship than a password. And yeah, that kind of thing, I do think, is... we talked about this before. I do suspect that there is something in the nature of... that there's more than just... any idiot who comes up and utters those syllables will have the door open for them. I would not be the least bit surprised if the magic of the door were somewhat more discerning than that. That intentions matter. Yes, exactly. And that trifle would indeed explain why Sauron, who has just betrayed friendship so spectacularly, can't get in. Yes. The one who just murdered his friend Celebrimbor? Yes. Murdered their mutual friend Celebrimbor? Yeah, exactly. Probably not going to work. Not going to work for him. And praise, that's exactly right. Will is always the center of magic in Tolkien's work. I totally agree. So I think we're not told that explicitly, but that seems to me very likely. And of course, if that were true, it's one of the other reasons why it would be safe. It's kind of, you know, we were talking about how the way it's written is a little bit of a riddle, right? The phrase isn't necessarily what you, like, it's not presented in the way that you necessarily think it would be. It gives a kind of clue that it's a riddle. That it's providing you with the password. But again, the one of the points that I was establishing last time is that it does, in fact, if you just read it aloud, you will, in fact, say the word, right? So that makes it not a very good riddle in that somebody could solve it accidentally, which you don't want a riddle that can be solved accidentally, generally. For Thoughtless is, of course, recalling how, like, elf friendship leaves a mark on you that others can see, right? Exactly. Friendship, it's, you can tell, right? That does suggest, yes, that there could be something sort of detectable about that. Yes. Anyway, so the point is, and is there something equivalent for a dwarf friend, Lupita? Nothing more likely. Why not? Right. We don't know. We don't have first, like, that doesn't come up in this story, right? Frodo is named an elf friend, and that is detectable on him by others at various points. Tom Bombadil can tell right away, right, that he's an elf friend as soon as he meets him. So that kind of thing happens. We don't have a similar, clear declaration from the text that dwarf friendship is equally detectable. Lupita says Gandalf helped dwarves before. Maybe he is marked as such. Possibly. I can't help but thinking ahead a little bit of Gimli's response to Galadriel. Could it not be that he also is detecting dwarf friendship unexpectedly to himself, right? That there is an element there as well, that he can sense that she's a dwarf friend. But anyway, yeah, or at least was a friend of the dwarves that are now gone. I still do believe that the magic of these doors is not just automatic. That it is not responding to those two syllables, you know, as if it were a clapper or something like that. I don't think it's merely blindly responding to the sounds. At least does not seem to fit how magic works. But notice that while that adds security significantly, possibly anti-Sauron security, as Strifel reminds us, it would also not do anything to undermine what Matt was saying about, you know, a sort of a declaration of permanent friendship with the elves of Eregion, right? It would mean an open way, you know, for all of the elf friends and dwarf friends. We don't know. Well, we don't get as much detail about the east doors as we get about these. But of course, remember the Bridge of Khazad-dûm itself is a major part of the defense of the east doors. They can defend the east doors, yes, but they don't seem to function like this. In fact, that would seem to be one of the purposes of having doors like this over here, is that this is far from the main center of their city. This is this is on the very outskirts, right, of Moria. This is a long ways away from their center, which I don't think the East Gates are, right? Based on what we're going to see of the geography of Moria, you know, the 21st Hall is a couple levels up, but it's not far away from where the entrance is, right? The main city of the dwarves seems to be focused, based on what we can see from the text, much closer to the western entrance. I keep getting it backwards in my head. These are the west gates, those are the east gates. That's what I was thinking. So the ones that face, now I'm confusing my own self. The ones that face Lorien, the east gates. That seems to be where their major city was, over on that side of the mountains. And so this was basically the back door. And so sometimes you just want to lock the back door, right? The east gates are the front doors. And so you don't just have an automatic lock on the front doors. Like, that's where you keep your guards and your defenses and things like that, right? Yeah, exactly. Khaled Zaram is right there. It's, again, from you think about the escape route, right, from the Chamber of Mazarbul down, you know, out the doors. It takes a little while, but it only takes a little while in the sense of, like, you know, going across and down the city, not the travel, you know, hours of travel from, you know, through, like, dark tunnels and stuff. So the east gates are very much the front doors. And therefore, they're not just going to be, like, automated in this same kind of way. But anyhow, yes, Matt, and it's an interesting thing to wonder. I wonder, because we don't get a clear sense of this, really. But I think probably the highway through the middle of Moria would have been in the time of the, you know, the height of Khazad Dûm, and certainly in the time of the prosperity of Eregion, would have been the most common way for the elves to cross the mountains through there. Why go over the pass of Carathras when you could go through Khazad Dûm? I can imagine that there might be some who would prefer the fresh air, right, and would prefer not to go under the mountains. But it certainly would have been an easier, more civilized road, right, than trekking up over the top. Certainly in winter, 100%. Yeah. Kurtzimus, it's a good question. Did those group of elves like each other? I think there's less toing and froing over the mountains than we might think, right? Apart from Galadriel herself, you know, and probably Celeborn, most of the Galadhrim wouldn't have had much to do with the elves of Eregion, I don't think. Probably less the dwarves of Khazad Dûm. But I can easily imagine elves taking the scenic route or enjoying the outdoors, right? I'm not at all suggesting that I think they would never have gone over the mountain instead. But I do think the road through Moria would have been probably a common, and certainly the fastest way, if you're in a hurry. Or if Carathras is grumpy, yes. Yeah. Would Carathras have been a problem back then? I gotta think Carathras is always a problem, right? I mean, Carathras is always a problem in the same sense that Old Man Willow is always a problem, right? Even for Bombadil, who can command him, right? But, I mean, he's always an issue. He's not always capturing hobbits, but, you know. But, yeah. I doubt that Carathras's grouchiness is very recent, right? Gimli's reference to Carathras being called the Cruel and having an ill name presumably is not merely recent. Yeah. Yeah, Maureen, you think that Karathras had heartburn having a Balrog in the basement? Yeah, yeah. This is one of my favorite things from the world building we did for Return to Moria. We invented a story that explained both why Karathras was grumpy and why the Balrog chose that hiding spot, and why Durin was called there in the first place. It was really fun. Anyway, okay. Well, Cal Elros, I don't like to brag, but I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I think that our story about Khazad Dûm was even better than the Song of the Hithai Gwyr. I think it was. Okay, anyway, one note I want to make here before we move on. Gimli's addition there at the end. What the word was is not remembered. So, it's sort of a funny note, right? They didn't write down what the word was. It's in their written records about the gates, the west gate, the east, west, darn it, west gates of Moria. I have a horrible problem. I have this, I do this all the time. I mess up my east and west on the maps of Middle Earth just like constantly. I this always happens to me, always has. I don't know why. But anyway, they wrote down this stuff about the West Gates, and but they didn't record the password. Because, of course, they didn't have to. They probably did, right? They probably did copy the inscription on the arch, but they didn't mention that it was the password because they didn't think they had to, right? They totally took it for granted. And so Gimli says what the word was is not remembered, and then adds, yeah, and Eric, I agree. I think that this is a very, Tolkien the medievalist would have encountered this sort of thing a lot, right? Eric says often in history, the stuff that's missing is the stuff that people never thought was needed because everybody knew it. Yes, that kind of thing happens, frustratingly, frequently. So it's a very believable thing, they would not include that because they thought it was totally unnecessary to say it. But also notice there seems to be Gimli seems to be making a false assumption, right? But it's a totally understandable one. They recorded in whatever these records were that Gandalf and Gimli have both read, they have recorded that there was an opening password that could be spoken and the doors would open, right? I mean, that's recorded, Gandalf says, and Gimli confirms, right? But they didn't record the password because they didn't think they needed to. But Gimli interprets that differently, right? Gimli thinks also that it's perfectly natural that they did not record the password because it's a secret, right? He assumes that that means the password is super secret, and that's why they didn't record it for security purposes, because that would track, right? And so he is correct about them, about the fact that the word has been forgotten. Yeah, so hang on a second. Which question, Johnny, which question are you thinking is sarcastic? So it is recorded, is it not, Gimli? Is that the question? I don't see sarcasm there. Yeah, no, I don't think it's sarcastic. I think it's true. I mean, Gimli's immediate response, it is, suggests that there is, in fact, a record. There's written lore on this that has survived. We don't know exactly where it's recorded. Somewhere where Gimli's read it and Gandalf has read it, apparently, right? That Gimli has studied about Moria should not surprise us at all, given how he has, given all the things that he says leading up to their approach, right? And what's more, given the importance of Khazad-dûm to the dwarves of Erebor, to the dwarves of Durin's line, the fact that all of the lore of Erebor that they can remember has been written down by them seems like, of course they would, right? Of course they would. Of course they would want to remember that. And yes, Two Juice Man, that's exactly how I read it too. That Gandalf is asking Gimli to confirm is him signifying that the source of this information is Dwarvish records. Yeah, I agree. I think that Gandalf is kind of citing his sources. Yes. And it's also very possible. I think he may genuinely be seeking confirmation from Gimli here. I think that Gandalf may be less than 100% confident in the thing that he just said, because I think it's very likely that he read these Dwarvish records a heck of a long time ago, and Gimli has probably read them much more recently than Gandalf has. And, Johnny, I do agree, he's also including Gimli generously, honoring Gimli in this moment. Yes. But again, I think he believes, and I think that he is correct. He seems to be correct, right? That Gimli would have also studied these same records about Moria, and B, probably remembers them more clearly than Gandalf does. I think that that's very likely straight up right there. I think that's very legit. Again, remember these records. My suspicion is that these records were written after the loss of Moria. It seems to me entirely plausible, more than plausible, entirely likely, probable. I'd go so far as probable to say that the first few generations of dwarves, the first couple generations of dwarves, after the flight from Khazad-dûm, after the Balrog emerges and the dwarves flee for good, in the first generation of exile, that many of the dwarves spent much of their time. You know, many of the dwarves who were, you know, adults when they were exiled from Khazad-dûm spent a lot of the rest of their careers writing about the marvels of Khazad-dûm that is lost, so that, you know, the dwarves to come would not forget them. I think that seems entirely probable. Yes, Greyhame, exactly similar to how the survivors of Numenor had to rewrite everything from memory after the fall. Yes, and not only that, but how Elendil wrote about Numenor, remembering it and thinking back on Numenor that was lost. That there would be Dwarvish records like this. Yes, this doesn't mean that there were records written in Moria that were taken away with them or something. I mean, that's possible. I wouldn't totally rule that out. But again, that lore survives from the heartbroken, homesick longing of the first and second generations after the loss of Moria, they would totally write this stuff down. And that leads to Gimli's final statement there. Narvi and his craft and all his kindred have vanished from the earth. It's the all his kindred that I find so interesting here. Gimli could say, like that, to say Narvi and his craft have vanished from the earth. Right? Let's just take that statement by itself for a moment. If Gimli just says Narvi and his craft have vanished from the earth, all he is saying is the lore of our forefathers back in Khazad Dûm was so great. Their craft was such that we can't possibly replicate it. Right? I can't tell you more about how these gates would work because we've lost the power to even make gates like this anymore. And of course, you'll remember that we heard things like that from Glóin in Rivendell in his conversation with Frodo, where there are some things that he humbly admits that they have progressed even beyond their forefathers with, but there are many things, the secrets of which have been lost. And they will never, you know, they can't forge armor and weapons as mighty as their forefathers used to do, right? But they, and so again, it would seem, this statement, Narvi and his craft have vanished from the earth, would be a statement just like that, right? I mean, that would just be Gimli saying, Narvi is a legend, right? There is no modern dwarf who could hope to do or even understand the craft of the great Narvi, right, whose secrets are lost. And certainly that is more of Tolkien's view that things were better in the past, Johnny. Absolutely. Yes, yes. Yeah, Lincoln is saying the same thing, that, you know, greatness being in the past, never to return, and present accomplishments being unable to equal them. Yep, yep, exactly, exactly. But the thing that I find interesting is all his kindred. Narvi and his craft and all his kindred have vanished from the earth. And that, I think, is a further statement of humility on Gimli's part. Right? He isn't only saying, we modern dwarves, we just can't compare. We just can't compare to the lore of Narvi and you know, our forefathers. But he could, like, link himself, right? I mean, in some sense, at least, surely, Gimli is of the kindred of Narvi. I'm not saying he's, like, of Narvi's house, that he's a lineal descendant of Narvi or something like that, but I mean, he's a Longbeard. These were his, you know, kindred in the past, right? He doesn't link himself to them. He could, but he doesn't link himself to them, right? He speaks of it as if it was a complete cataclysm, as if all the dwarves of Khazad Dûm died and none were exiled and there were no survivors and no descendants, right? Matt, I think that's interesting. Matt says, Narvi and his craft and all his kindred sounds like Gimli is quoting from a lament. Possibly. That line, Narvi and his craft and all his kindred have vanished from the earth, might be a quotation. That's very possible. That's very possible. It certainly kind of has that feel to some extent, right? Yeah, it is possible, T. Juice Man, that Narvi's house has perished, right? That, you know, different different houses of the dwarves of Khazad-dûm specialized, you know, so that like Narvi was of a family of door makers, right? Like that, you know, dwarf doors like this were the specialty of the, you know, of this one particular dwarf house, and that house has gone, and so there are no survivors to whom that, you know, generational knowledge has been passed on. I think that's possible. I agree, Matt. I think you're right. The phrasing there is suggestive. Narvi and his craft and all his kindred have vanished from the earth. The alliteration, the cadence of that. And the sort of formality of it. I don't know. Possibly. I don't think it's a smoking gun, but I think it's very much a possibility. And certainly Gimli is in a frame of mind. He is, of course, recalling very clearly the things that he has read in the records about Moria, and which is why he's so quick with his confirmation. It is, right? I think he has a lot of these things running through his head right now. Narvi and his craft and all his kindred have vanished from the earth. Well, in any case, TGS Man, getting back to your suggestion about that this might be, there might in fact be no descendants of Narvi. And so again, therefore, the idea of that knowledge being passed through families, that could be the reference that Gimli is making to the kindred. Possibly. I think it's also possible that he might be, I wonder if it's possible that he could mean the word kindred a little bit more metaphorically than that. Rather than imagining a house of gate makers or door makers, if he just means essentially something more like his peers, right? Narvi and his craft and everybody like him, right? Everybody who was like unto him in craft, have vanished from the earth. No dwarves, any dwarf who is capable of work of this kind, of work of this wonder, have all vanished from the earth now. Yeah, like his ilk, exactly. Narvi and all his ilk. Exactly. Tell you, it's possible that it was a family thing. It's possible that he just means Narvi and every comparably gifted craftsman. All of the comparably gifted craftsmen of old are gone now. More like his kind, Eric. Exactly. He is using the word kindred, so he would have to be using the word kindred sort of metaphorically, right? But still. The thing that I would point out is from the start, Gimli is emphasizing not the connection between himself and Moria. So I'm kind of stepping back from Narvi in particular here, and I'm thinking about Gimli's attitude as a whole. And I'm thinking here about the kind of excitement that we have seen in Gimli all of this day, right? This very different day that Gimli is having, right? As I've said many times. Gimli is Gimli could, given all the excitement that we've seen, one possible reaction he could be having as he's now here at the doors and imagining he's about to, Gimli is about to step foot inside Khazad-dûm, for crying out loud, right? Something which his forefathers have longed to do for generations. And, Dan, the king himself, once stood in the doorway and looked in, right? But to actually step in, right? Anyway, as I say, one reaction that Gimli could be having on this momentous occasion would be one of identification, right? He could be thinking, feeling, saying things that showed us that he's thinking, I've come home. This is my place. This is where I belong, right? Again, he could be linking it to himself, connecting himself to it, right? He could be saying, this is the hall of my forefathers, right? This is the long-lost ancestral home of my family. And I don't mean it in like a prideful way or an inappropriate way. I think that would be a perfectly sensible and reasonable response for Gimli to have. But again, the thing, what I'm all kind of trying to come back to here is, actually, that's a really good parallel. Johnny, you're on fire tonight, Johnny. Like Aragorn on Weathertop and with the Sword of Elendil. Yeah, exactly. When Aragorn was thinking about Elendil standing there, waiting for Gil-galad to come, right? It was a kind of connection with himself, right? He was feeling, and there it's just like a parallel. I mean, goodness, think of how distant Elendil is connected to Aragorn. I mean, it's an important connection on account of he's carrying Elendil's broken sword on his hip at the moment, right? But still, it's but anyway, my point is, this sentence suggests to me that that's not Gimli's reaction. He's not connecting himself. That's not what he's doing. What he's doing instead is almost the opposite, right? Instead, he's not perceiving closeness. He's perceiving distance, right? His first impressions here are, man, this is so far beyond me, right? I'm not even connected to this, right? And I think that that's it's interesting. Remember, we will hear Gimli talk like this later on. I think this isn't just a little data point that we can hold on to and put with others as we see Gimli responding from within Moria as we go. Okay. Hey, let's start the next slide. Let's just do it. But do you not know the word Gandalf? Asked Boromir in surprise. No, said the wizard. The others looked dismayed, only Aragorn, who knew Gandalf well, remained silent and unmoved.
"Then what was the use of bringing us to this accursed spot?" cried Boromir, glancing back with a shudder at the dark water. "You told us that you had once passed through the mines. How could that be if you did not know how to enter?"
"The answer to your first question, Boromir," said the wizard, "is that I do not know the word yet. But we shall soon see. And," he added with a glint in his eyes, under their bristling brows, "you may ask what is the use of my deeds when they are proved useless. As for your other question, do you doubt my tale, or have you no wits left? I did not enter this way. I came from the east."
All right. So, Boromir has finally lost it. Right? We've seen Boromir has been pushed. Boromir has been so patient. I mean, he has been so patient. We have seen him go out of his way. We have seen him go out of his way not to challenge. He's been very diplomatic. Even when he has clearly felt that nobody on this expedition knows what they're doing. He has had lots of questions about the leadership, of the decisions being made by the leadership. We saw him come close before, right? When they set out here, the whole Moria discussion, right? When he, like, called for a vote, you know, that was, calling for a vote was the nearest thing, right? The nearest he's come to openly challenging the leadership of this expedition. But he loses it. He loses it here. What was the use of bringing us to this accursed spot? You told us that you had once passed through the mines. How could that be if you did not know how to enter? The first question, do not you know the word, Gandalf? That question seems dragged out of him in his surprise, right? Like, he is so incredulous that Gandalf doesn't know the words, or that Gandalf might not know the words, right? Which he seems to be detecting from the drift, right? Yeah, good. Thanks. I was just thinking about that too, guys. Do not you know the word, Gandalf, is interesting phrasing, I think. Do you not know the word is a question. Do not you know the word is unusual phrasing. I agree that the natural phrasing of the question would be, do you not know the word? I think it is, yes, that's exact. Eric, I think you have it exactly there. As Gildalwin is just saying too, it emphasizes the you. She says, do you not know? Not knowing is the emphasis. Do you not know the word? Not knowing would just be a thing that Gandalf is doing in that moment, right? Do not you know the word? Like, surely, and remember, it's immediately in response to, if they were shut, any who knew the opening word could speak it and pass in. It is, but what the word was is not remembered. But do not you know the word? Right? So he's not saying, like, hang on, Gandalf, what do you mean you don't know the word? He's not assuming that. So in a sense, I think he's still a little bit polite here. Nerdosapiens, I would say it does emphasize that we don't. I don't disagree with you that the word not is emphasized. What I would say is the word not is the vehicle for emphasis. Right. Instead of emphasizing not no, it's emphasizing not you. Right. The not is the mechanism by which the emphasis is laid. Right. So in that sense, I think I agree with you. Do you see the difference of what I'm suggesting there? It's absolutely because the word not is the crucial word in that question that the word order comes into relevance, right? But anyway, I actually think that although he's surprised here, Dizzy, I agree. I think that there is a shred of diplomacy left in that first question. Do not you know the word? Wait. Surely you know the word, Gandalf, right? Right. I mean, I would paraphrase this as, but you're going to tell me now that you know that word, right, Gandalf? It may not be recorded in Gimli's books, right? But obviously, you know it, right? And Gandalf just says no. And Emily, I agree. Emily says that Gandalf kind of asks for the retort by simply replying no. Yes, exactly. It's like you of all people, Nerdosapiens. Yeah, exactly. Like he's the question, do not you know the word, Gandalf? There's still a shadow, at least, of benefit of the doubt there, right? Like, I'm assuming, Gandalf, that you know the word, right? Say yes. Tell me I'm right, that you know the word. It's like he has this sudden dark suspicion has leapt into his mind that Gandalf doesn't know the word, but he doesn't just accuse him, right? He doesn't, you know, he could be worse here. Right. Boromir's response to that exchange between Gimli and Gandalf could be like, and now you're going to tell me that you don't even know the word either. Right. Am I right? Right. And let me guess, you don't know the word, Gandalf. Right. And now we're hosed. Right. It is true, Eric, if you put in the contraction, it would sound quite natural. Don't you know the word? And if you ask it that way, don't you know the word, Gandalf? You can hear it. That is the assumption that he probably does. Surely he must, right? Don't you know the word, Gandalf? It's a question which almost invites the answer, yes. Do not you know the word, Gandalf? And then Gandalf just says no. Actually, yes, I think do you not know the word does feel completely different, actually. Do you not know the word is a question that presumes he doesn't know it and is seeking confirmation. Do you not know the word? Again, it's what is being knotted, right? Yes, not you and not no. It is a different emphasis. To say, like, he's not suggesting Gandalf doesn't know the word. Don't you know the word? Don't you? Even the structure of that, it's the structure of a question that assumes the answer is going to be yes. Don't you know the word? And so there's a kind of Eric, all right. I'm not sure I agree that Gandalf's answer is strictly matter of fact. It's the exclamation point is one thing. I agree with Jackie. One is his exclamation point. But the second is that he is... Whenever you answer no to a question that assumes the answer yes, it's jarring. Right? There's something a little bit... There's something a little bit off-putting. There's something a little off-putting in saying no to a question which assumes the answer yes, right? Then there's the exclamation point also. And yes, I suspect Gandalf is as irritated at his answer as Boromir is too. That Gandalf is expressing some frustration on his own. Gandalf knows the pressure. He knows how much trouble they're in if they can't open the door. And I don't think, as I said, there are still shreds of diplomacy clinging to the question Boromir just asked, right? Because it does at least, there's a certain amount of benefit of the doubt that it gives to Gandalf in the way that he's framed that question. It's not just skeptical. It's not just scathing from the very beginning, right? He's not just, I told you so-ing from, you know, the first moment he starts speaking there. But the question is undiplomatic in the sense that it pushes Gandalf to say, like, Gandalf has to say, he doesn't want to say no aloud. He's been kind of avoiding that, right? If he knew the answer, he'd have been talking about this whole situation differently from when they first read the inscription, right? This is why Boromir has finally been pushed to let this out, because, like, he's had this sinking feeling that Gandalf doesn't know how to get in, right? But anyway, like, I think Gandalf is annoyed. He knows the pressure they're in, and he doesn't like admitting that he doesn't know. Lupita's wondering if he hoped to figure it out before they noticed. Possibly. And he is under an incredible amount of pressure and knows that he's under an incredible amount of pressure. And having Boromir, like, draw that out and emphasize it is not fun, right? Yeah, he's being called out, basically, Maureen. Yeah, exactly. Notice everybody looks dismayed, and only Aragorn, who knew Gandalf well, remained silent and unmoved. Do you see what that tells us about this scene? What does that tell us about this scene? Which is nowhere else indicated in this passage. What does it tell us about everyone else except Aragorn? Right? It tells us everybody is shouting. They're all losing their minds. Exactly. Everybody is losing their minds. Only Aragorn remained silent. Everybody else has something to say. Boromir is not the only one responding this way. Everyone is, like, surprised. And yes, there is trust here. They not only lack his faith in Gandalf, they lack his experience with Gandalf. Right? Only Aragorn, who knew Gandalf well, remained silent and unmoved. And by the way, I think this is not just... It's not just that he knows Gandalf well in the sense that, you know, he trusts that Gandalf is going to come up with something and get them out of this. Yes. But I think there's also more than that, too. I think that he didn't have to ask that question because he knew that Gandalf didn't know. He knows Gandalf well enough to know how to read, how he is, and what his plan was and what he's thinking, and that he is going to be confident that he's going to come up with the word to open the doors, and that Aragorn assumes he's gonna, right? So, like, he's Gandalf is under a lot of pressure. But Gandalf, I think, is not lacking confidence, as he's going to go on and say, I don't know the word yet. But we shall soon see, he's going to say. Aragorn's already been in we shall soon see mode, right, for some time here. Christmas says, wizards open doors precisely when they mean to. That's exactly right. Yes. Anyway, and yes, Gil-Dalawin, you're right. He remains not only silent, but also unmoved. And yes, this means we are invited to imagine that everyone else, though I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt to Bill the Pony, but everybody else, with the exception of Aragorn and possibly Bill the Pony, is neither silent nor unmoved in this moment. Everyone is surprised and upset and exclaiming. Okay, yeah, the Watcher in the Water probably also. Silent, but maybe not unmoved, who knows. You know, Bill is still there, Varden-Dale. He's been unpacked, but he's not, he's still around. Yes, everyone else is unsilent and moved, Gil-Dalawin. I agree. Now, we don't know what everybody's saying. Right? Like, we don't know the dynamics of this conversation. Is everybody shouting at Gandalf? Is everybody, exclaiming in outrage? Is everybody yelling at him? You know, no, we don't know that. Right? We don't know who's saying what and how this is all going down, right? Right, how many of them aired are just gasps and wordless cries, general chaos of conversation. Yeah, exactly. We don't know, right? But we've been gently invited to, and I believe that Boromir's explosion in the next paragraph is one of the many things that people are saying. The narrator and Gandalf focus in on the unsilent and moved thing that Boromir says because it's the weightiest of all of the things, right? This is the one that really matters. This is the really big deal. And yes, Stun Duck, that's exactly what I'm building up to. That it's an important thing to apply to Boromir's next sentence. Because reading it, one generally does not give voice to the others in one's head. To remember that Boromir says that everybody's saying stuff, right? Boromir's saying is the only one's going to get quoted. And it's the only one Gandalf's going to respond to that we're told about. Though he has some words for Pippin pretty soon, too. But I think it's an important context to remember when we come back to Boromir's exclamation here, when Boromir finally says his first genuinely and 100% undiplomatic thing that he said since we've met him. This is not just everybody else remaining respectfully and trustingly silent and Boromir, you know, losing his cool. Everyone, Aragorn is the only one with cool, He's it. And Aragorn is the sole repository of cool on this entire of this, including Gandalf, right? Gandalf losing his cool too. Aragorn abides with the cool. Everyone else is losing it. And I think that's it's easy, Stunduck, as you say, to not remember that. When we hear Boromir's statement. Anyway, okay. Next time we'll focus in, we'll discuss more Boromir's undiplomatic statement next time. And we will see. Join us next time when we will see if I can talk myself into believing that what Boromir says is still really diplomatic. But I don't think so this time. So we're going to, it's a field trip time here this evening. I do want to note before folks leave, I'm not going to be around next week. Next week, I'm going to be traveling with my family. I'm going to be hauling skis around and carrying hot chocolate and things like that while other people ski who have the ability to ski, which I lack. But anyway, so I'm going to be on slopes in or near slope, not on them, near slopes in Vermont next week. So I won't be here next week, but I should be back the week after. A little footnote attached to most of my broadcasts is that the week after next is the week in which my other kid's going to be home from college. Now, coming home from college, he's going to have many other things to do than hang out with his dad, I don't doubt. But but things may be coming up and happening there that I don't know about. So we will. So there's a non-zero chance that something's going to come up on the Tuesday that I don't know about yet, but probably not. My plan is to have our class on, what'll that be, the 5th or something like that, of March. But anyway, whatever the first Tuesday in March is, that's the one that will probably be, but don't be 100% shocked if I have to postpone that one too. And yes, Lady Shmebuak, I have a kid in college. He's a junior, finishing his junior year now, believe it or not. Yep. All right. So it is time to go inside the gate and approach the doors of Durin. Here on our field trip. I'm going to go out and come back in again, as I usually do. Thanks to everybody who can't stay with us for the field trip, and I'll see you guys next week. Also, so I'm going to make an embarrassing confession also that, and that is that, oops, no, that's the wrong one. And that is that I totally forgot to do the quest line to get poor Narnian in the door. So here's what's going to happen. I'm going to phone a friend. That is, I'm going to bring I'm going to bring Griffith in.
All right. Do you know where Griffith's going to show up? If you'll be able to get to the gates, okay?
Yeah, I'll get there. I should get there.
Okay. In that case, I will meet you at, what was it, Ekhad Dunan?
Yeah, actually, you know, it might be easier. Hang on a second. I can't talk and type my password at the same time. Okay. It might be easier to summon me or something.
I can summon you directly to the door. Well,
okay.
To the outside of the door.
Okay.
Yeah, all right.
That'd be cool. Oh, and Aranos can too. Cool.
Excellent.
Yes, because Griflet is in Minas Tirith. So I could make it back in a few hops, but it would take a few hops.
Yeah.
All right. So let's bring Griflet, who has definitely been through Moria and can do this. All right. Okay. So Grifflet is in, if you want to do the...
Okay.
Raid invitation.
Yep.
Here's Grifflet in the House of the Healing. Hanging all out right. with the Yorith and Mithrandir. There's Faramir in his bed. Not looking good at all. Yikes, Faramir looks like a corpse already.
Eat some porridge.
Yeah. He needs some porridge? I wonder why Yorith didn't think of that.
Well, there's a war on. Maybe they don't have porridge.
Thank you, Aranos. No, you don't have to worry for the sake of the walking trees, JJ. It'll be fine.
So, like, I don't know. This whole section with Gandalf blowing up, I feel like everyone finally needs to, like, let off a little steam. Like, this has just been building up with the stress and the tension, and just, like, we were just waiting for somebody to just crack him at this point.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and you know he's going to think all the better for it afterwards, but... The bit where it says, and Aragorn said nothing. I just picture him, like, rolling his eyes and thinking, oh boy, here we go.
Yeah. Yep.
Such a drama queen.
All right. Okay.
We're going to go through. If you can't go through, it's probably because you haven't got the quest yet. There's nothing I can do about that, sadly.
Yep. All right. So here we are. So now first let's look at the map here. Ah, still the old map. Okay. All right. So we are on the winding path. So this is significant because this is, if we remember, the path that we were looking at, that whose description we were reading, where they were coming in with the... I don't think there's enough landscape detail to get the whole, like, when the path fell away on one side that we were looking at for what seemed like an hour and a half that one time. But anyway, the mountains kind of closing around and entering into this sort of, like, canyon area, right?
Yeah.
So I like the fact that the LOTRO developers have picked up on that sense of... it wasn't exactly claustrophobia, but of the... of the closeness of things and the frowning mountains around them, so that when we get here inside this area right on the sort of threshold of Moria, things kind of close in on us a bit, right? Uh-huh. We do get this, you know, this self-contained map area that they have here along the Saranan does recall that description. Now... As I recall, there's some area across the stream here, right?
Yeah, I think so.
How do we get over there? I mean, we can just drop down, can't we?
Yeah, I think so.
Without too much trouble?
Yeah. If you go down at an angle, you'll be fine.
Okay, because I couldn't remember. There was a cave over here, but what I just wanted to check and see was if they put any ruins over here. Any evidence that there was any construction by elf or dwarf within this canyon. Yeah, down here is what I was remembering, and that's just a cave entrance.
Yeah.
So we've got a bunch of wargs hanging out here, as if all of these... And these are shadow wargs, too, right?
Yeah, black guys.
Yeah, so these are the shadow wargs, which presumably means this is the group of wargs that was pursuing the Fellowship. You know, came too late, and so they're still kind of hanging about. I don't remember. What's in the cave?
Wargs, I think, but I'm not sure.
Just like wargs and
beasties?
Orcs in here?
I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Okay.
It's been a while.
Yeah, me too. All right, so it's
still
just...
Still gone.
Just, yeah, infested with goblins. And, oh, Gryffalo, it never went in here. So
huh.
I don't have this on my map, but it's huge, as I recall. Okay, so this is...
Yeah.
But there's not any clear evidence of, like, dwarvish... occupation. What I'm trying to establish here is not like the plot basis of this in Lotro, but architecturally speaking, is there evidence that this complex was in use in Moria times, like during the Second Age? Yeah, was it? And no, it's all rough hewn caves, and yeah,
maybe they were starting on something and abandoned it.
Right.
Greenstan said he found a pillar on one of the hills. Looks like part of an elven pillar, of all things.
Outside there?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't...
Posted a screenshot.
I think it's all like this. The caves, I mean. We don't have to explore this whole cave system.
Yeah, this
which
is just...
Fairly
this old. Is something that was opened by nature or was started and never finished.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. Okay.
Is this the way out? Am
yeah,
I going the right
way? This is the way out.
Okay. No, I went the wrong way. Don't follow me.
Uh-oh, you went the wrong way. Oops.
Yeah.
Okay. So hang on. So,
those aren't meant to be underground.
Right. You put up. There's a blue beacon somewhere up on a hill where.
Yeah. Could you? Do you have another beacon? Could you put it up?
I see it.
Yep.
I see it. Okay. All right. Aha.
Dwarf candles come in very handy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love dwarf candles.
And very appropriate.
They're useful in field trips.
Oh, look at that.
Oh, yeah. That
oh.
looks like a lot of what we've seen in Iridium.
Yep, little fragment of elvish construction, all right.
Yep.
What an odd little bit.
Well, yeah.
Because it looks like, not only does it look like a little bit of a much larger thing, but it looks like the upper, it doesn't look like the bottom of a wall. It looks like the top
no.
of a wall.
Yeah, it looks like one of the top arches that we
yeah.
usually see with the little filigree windows.
Very weird.
I wonder if it just slid down the hill, like the top part broke off and slid down the hill like this.
Yeah, but very Iregian, though. Okay, so...
Yes, very.
And it's hardly surprising. And that's why I wanted to come over here and look to see if we could find any ruins, because I wouldn't have been the least bit surprised to find any, because this is, I mean, we're right here. You know, we had outside the gates, right? We
mm-hmm.
had Ekhad Dunan, which was like the, you know, the west, the welcome area, right? But that the elves would build something over here, you know, who knows, along the last part of the way seems perfectly likely that they would.
Mm-hmm.
And that one piece looks like the piece of a, again, I suggest something elaborate. I thought when JJ said he found a pillar or something, that it was just like one of those like dwarf landmark pillars or something like
mm-hmm.
that. But no, that's a
genuine
fragment of elf ruin.
Yeah, I did not expect that.
Yeah. But again, not shocking that they would, you know, do something like this. Okay.
How'd they get across the river?
How do we get across the river?
Because the Saranen would normally be in full flow.
Oh, right.
So,
like, normally, how would they get across the river? Yeah.
Well, there's a pathway that goes around it that we are not taking. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It goes down into the riverbed.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Like... Well, they might have had a bridge over here in the old days or something. a little small bridge.
Mm-hmm.
See, we're going to be... This should take us right up next to the Stair Falls. Okay, there's the waterfall. The dry waterfall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ooh, I like the green algae all over it.
Yeah.
That's a nice touch.
Yeah, that's fun. I like that, yeah.
It implies there's just enough water trickling nearby to feed all of that.
Right. Or that it's, you know, recent enough that it's still green. And here's the stairs next to the stair falls. And so we go up the stairs like Bill the Pony apparently can't do. Because, mm-hmm. you know, Bill isn't a Lotro horse, which can go up and down stairs at high speeds. And this brings
us... Only to plummet to his death later.
There we go. So here we have... Black Pool.
Yep.
And across sure the way, we can see the holly tree. Well, we can see...
What's left of them.
Yeah.
Spoilers.
We can see what's left of the holly trees. I'm a little disappointed that we can't just make out the remnant of the avenue. Like the trees that are grown around are... Now, of course, it's perfectly plausible that the nice, neat avenue of trees that was there thousands of years ago grew into a large, you know, a free-range forest in this valley. You know, that hardly seems unlikely.
Also, if the waterfall's blocked up, it might be underwater right now, and they might be the remains of these trunks that are seeing.
Right. No. I'm just saying... I'm just saying, you know, we don't see any evidence of the avenue, you know, that they were planted in an avenue. But yeah, I agree, Aranos. Groves, with the amount of time that has passed, there's no reason to imagine that you would only see the avenue remaining.
Yes. Especially in so insalubrious location.
Yes. Yes, it is a nicely unwholesome looking lake.
Yeah, it's grody.
All right. Okay, let's go around. Let's go around, because I want to go around the other path.
Yeah, we have to take the pathway to get to the walkable part.
Exactly. And that's the way they ended up going around with Bill anyway.
Yep.
So there's the path here that winds around.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, where'd it go? I didn't go far enough. Yeah, just took
it. It loops around.
I just went around the corner. But yeah, the loop starts further down. Yeah. Right, because isn't there like a merchant or something down here?
Mm-hmm. But it would also make sense. You'd have this nice steady grade for wheeled vehicles or carts.
Yeah.
Can't imagine how, if you had to go up and down those stairs all day.
Yes.
Never skipping leg day. You'd have some killer calves.
Okay, so this is the gentle path that Gimli mentioned, up around to the left. And then we come down to the edge of the lake.
That part's not quite as gentle either. That was a pretty steep slope there.
But it's, you know, horsable.
Yeah. You just have to put a little plank behind the wheels when you stop for a minute.
So here we go. Now we've, let's see, just getting our bearings.
Oh,
we can see
slimy rocks everywhere.
There they are, the remnants of the trees, way across there.
Yeah.
So we now have to skirt all the way around the edge. And the water has receded a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Aha, uh-huh. And here's a place where we have to ford over the greasy stones. The water which feels unwholesome on your feet. And there are some recent graves that are more recent than the fellowship. And then you finally come all the way around.
These eldritch looking dead trees.
Yes. So now, it's interesting to me, this, the choice that they made here, I have to admit I don't fully understand it. The adaptation choice that the Lotro people have made. On the one hand, they don't depict the trees torn up by the roots. Which, on the one hand, the text is only going to, I mean, they don't see it, right? They're just going to hear it, and it's going to sound like the trees are being ripped up by their roots. And Gandalf is going to lament for the trees as if they definitely were destroyed. Anyway, it's to me a slightly strange choice.
Well, you could see this one's been cracked in half up at the top, the one here on the right.
Yep. Yeah, you can see damage.
That's a fatal blow. This tree is dead.
Right. Yeah, no, you can see damage. But that's the other thing, is that in addition to showing the trees still there or mostly there, they show the trees as like all, you know, lichen covered and like corroded, basically. Like these are grody looking trees. Very much as if they, like, as if the scum of the lake has been, and I know we've got people like swimming and fishing here in
not the advisable
hideous water. But, just as we can see the dead and choked stumps out in the lake. And by the way, see how you can see from this side, the trees that have been piled up over the exit to dam up the lake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The point is, Gandalf says these trees are beautiful, and these trees are not beautiful. So, like, it would be one thing if they showed just ripped up trees, you know, ripped out of the ground and thrown around, right? That would be one thing if they showed that. And then it would be another thing also if they just showed them still in their glory as before, right? But what we're getting is like neither of those things, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I find it a puzzling choice. I don't understand why we have surviving, but I don't know, kind of sickly looking trees.
Maybe the contamination fully got them after the attack.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, like, it's as if what they're depicting is not trees that were wrenched up by the Watcher, but rather trees that have finally succumbed to the influence of the lake, which is, it's interesting. But again, it's one way, I guess, to kind of have your cake and eat it too, to show that they've been ruined, basically, as Gandalf suggests, but still to have them there as like landmarks from the other side.
There are leaves on them, but they're all brown and kind of dried out, Rowan.
Yeah, they are. But still, I mean, Yeah.
I have a theory.
Yeah?
Hmm?
What if the Watcher threw a fit and was, like, splashing around and basically throwing a temper tantrum because its prey escaped and, you know, got through the door, and it just kind of fling water and algae and whatever around, and it just decorated the trees like it's some weird Christmas.
Oh, I thought you were going to suggest something like the trees themselves stood up with the, on their roots with the last of their energy and chased it off before succumbing.
Well, I was wondering, well, if the trees didn't get uprooted, what were the noises that Gandalf was hearing or causing
right.
him to think that they were getting uprooted?
Well, right. I mean, there is a little leeway.
Roots being severed without them falling over.
Right. And again, as you know, Valeria, as you point out, the right hand tree is very much damaged, right? So there is evidence that damage has been done there.
See, there's broken roots over here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Freshly broken.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there is root damage. We do have that.
Yeah. So it's, but well, yeah,
strange.
I
don't remember these trees being here. I remember there being two sickly bushes that were uprooted and on the side, but I don't remember these big majestic trees being here. Maybe I'm remembering it wrong.
Yeah, when the doors are standing open, of course, because
mm-hmm.
Moria has been re-entered. And it is true, like, I will say, you know, there have been times when the Lotro developers if they can find an excuse in the text to do a thing they want to do, right, or to leave a thing they want to leave, they'll take it, right? If they can find a justification for it, for something that they want to do, they'll make that work, right? And so the fact that the text never actually describes, all we hear is the ruckus, right? The text doesn't actually describe what happens to the trees, gives them some liberty to say, hey, look, you can't prove that they were actually wrenched up by the roots. Anyway, so it's you know, it is possible that they would, you know, it is for the, in that way sort of negatively justifiable, but it's just still, it's, I feel like it's a, like neither of the two things. Neither what I think I should see nor what I wish I could see is what I'm seeing. If you see what I mean by that, right? What I think I should see is the trees ripped up and destroyed and knocked over. What I wish I could see is the trees in their beautiful glory, untouched and undamaged. But I'm not getting either one of the, either what I think I ought to see or what I wish I could see. But, yeah.
I mean, in my heart, yeah, I want there to still be trees there and just to see what's left of them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. McBombadil says, ugly trees is the natural compromise between those two. Well, yes, natural compromise in the sense of giving me neither of these things, right? But
yeah, beaten with the ugly stick.
Yeah. I do think they are, though, ugly.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you've ever tried to pull up like a one of those, like a locust tree or a tree that takes fast root, it takes a lot to get them out of the ground. You can rip those roots up as hard as you can, but getting it out of the ground is a second thing altogether.
Yeah.
You can imagine, you know, trying to pull these things up, you'd have to take half the mountain with it.
Right. And you do, there is a quest that we're skipping over here, where you help to clear away the debris that is piled up in front of the door. So the idea that the Watcher piled stuff against the door is retained in the game. It's just apparently not the whole trees. Yeah. Anyway, all right. Well, it's getting late. Next week, I think we can. We're going to beat the company into Moria, of course, by a couple classes. But I think we can go. I mean, once we get in,
We're going to be there for a while.
We're going to be there for a while, and the correspondences are not. That is just like that. It's going to be a while before we get to anything that's described in the text inside of Moria.
Should we head inside and get a milestone or leave that?
Yeah, let's do that.
And if you weren't able to make it in this week, just make sure you take the level 50 quest to enter into Moria, and next time you can come in with us.
Yep, exactly.
Get your legendary item.
I'm not even going to bother because Grifflet doesn't need this milestone. But I'll come back with Narnian and get it so that I'll be ready next week. All right. Very good. Grifflet still has his extremely useful 21st Hall milestone, which I have retained ever since I got to the 21st Hall. Because it's still one
of my... We're nowhere near the 21st Hall, though.
No, we're not. We're not. I'm just saying Grifflet always has a Moria milestone to hand, because the 21st Hall is my favorite crafting hall shopping combo.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me. Also, if you want to go through Moria mounted, you'll need a goat mount.
Right. Yes.
That was the other one.
Yes. Yes, that's true. We'll have to get a goat. Okay. Actually, I think...
Griffith... Boars work as well.
Huh?
Boars work as well.
Oh, yeah. Boars, piggies, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, Griffith does... have his Minas Tirith milestone, so he's okay.
Okay.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, we'll be back next week. I will try to come back with Narnian next week. Worst case scenario is I will still have Grifflet for next week, so we'll see what we can do. All right? Very good. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us. We shall look about us here in Moria, inside Moria next time, and begin our explorations of the Lotro adaptation of Moria. But thanks very much, everybody. Have a good night. See you guys not next week, but the week after. Bye now.
Bye.